minute. I'm going to talk about Red Hat Enterprise Linux. John, is someone going to talk about Fedora separately?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll have to touch on that too. So what's the sales pitch for RHEL? Basics first. Enterprise Linux is a binary distribution. It's using EXT3 file system, GNOME desktop in preference. It's RPM-based for its packaging, using Yum as well. The current release of Enterprise Linux is known as 5.1. It was released in November last year. That comes in two flavors. It's got a server variant and a client variant. And they're based on 2.6.18, plus a lot of other newer stuff. It's released in a number of architectures. So obviously the most popular one is x86, but also x86-64, IA64, PowerPC, and S390. So available on a wide variety of hardware. Principally, Enterprise Linux, as the name suggests, and as you probably gather, is targeted at business and government-style users. And it's principally used as a server platform. No surprises there. The business model underlying Enterprise Linux is a subscription model. So one point I particularly wanted to clarify, because sometimes there is a misunderstanding, Red Hat Enterprise Linux doesn't include any proprietary software. There are no proprietary drivers, no proprietary codecs. It's strictly open source. Okay? The box set of Enterprise Linux does have a supplementary CD, which does have some other software like Acrobat Reader and BEA, JRocket, and a few other things that we can't include in the base distribution for obvious reasons. But Enterprise Linux is strictly open source. Okay, the design emphasis of Enterprise Linux is security and stability at the expense of latest and greatest. So this principle manifests through from a user point of view in that you'll see that as updates are released, we don't generally release more recent versions of the packages. So for example, the kernel is 2.6.18, and Enterprise Linux 5 will always have a 2.6.18 kernel, or one that's 2.6.18 based. That can be a problem if you want something more recent, but from a point of view of people who've got software that's certified to run on Enterprise Linux, it we believe it greatly reduces the capacity for side effects arising from updates. So, emphasis on security, people can apply updates with reasonable confidence that there aren't going to be side effects from doing so. Enterprise Linux includes SE Linux, which is enabled out of the box. It comes with Xen as our virtualization. And I'm sure you're probably aware that Enterprise Linux uses Fedora. The Fedora project is our community variant. So, Enterprise Linux and Fedora are two sides of the same coin, in my opinion. So Enterprise Linux 5 was based on Fedora Core 5, I think. And, for example, Enterprise Linux 6 will probably be based on Fedora 10 or Fedora 9. Enterprise Linux has got a number of well-known derivatives, the Oracle derivative and CentOS. So, in my opinion, imitation is the finest form of flattery. So, that's the basics of Enterprise Linux. And John,
what's the policy regarding release schedule?
The policy regarding release schedule: the major releases are about every 2 years. So, Enterprise Linux 5 was January 2007. So you can probably make an educated guess that Enterprise Linux 6 will probably be around January 2009. We've gone to a dot release thing. In previous versions, we had like Enterprise Linux 4, and we did an update schedule, like update 1, update 2, update 3. Now we've gone to a more specific dot release. So now we've got 5.1. We didn't talk about 0.1 before. Now we do. So that makes it a slight change from the past. Oh, can you do an in-place upgrade of a machine that's... you didn't used to be able to, but you can with Enterprise Linux 5 do an in-place upgrade, but it's obviously still recommended you do a backup.
So Red Hat's policy on Cardex and things like that with
Titan? As in, will we include them? No, we won't include any encumbered technology. So we're pretty clear about that. Nothing else?
No.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Shane, would you like to come up next? So next we have Shane Owenby.
So quite appropriate in this context for Oracle to follow Red Hat. I'll explain how our distribution works and why it works the way it does. Now, after this, a new reverb there. After this, I've got a much longer talk on the same topic, so I'll just give you a short to the point, and then we can go from there. Why would Oracle copy Red Hat? It's more the point of why we did not want to create yet another distribution. As John said at the beginning, we've already got too many distributions. We're completely focused on the server side. Do not have a client offering. Do not take the client offering from Red Hat. We just take what's called AS from Red Hat and make it our own. So if you take a look at what happens, you've got Upstream, you've got Fedora, you've got RHEL, and that's the progression of path, just as Richard explained. Right? And then from there, the next step is to go to Oracle Enterprise Linux, which is exactly the same as Red Hat Enterprise Linux, sans the trademarks and copyrights. Yeah? So it's CentOS, those of you in the know, similar thing. Right? Now, where does Oracle invest? You know, we could invest and create our own distribution, but again, that's just going to fragment a market that we see no value back to customers on. So we took the leading enterprise distribution, focused on the data center, focused on the places where our customers are going to be using it, and we cloned that, and then we provide investment in a number of different ways. Number one, so everything technically Richard said is exactly the same. We're RPM-based, we're on a 2.6.18, we follow their schedule, so I can cover that, but it's just a repetition of what he said plus what I'm telling you now. Okay, so we have two ways of investing. Number one, we hire engineers and have them focus upstream. Okay, so that's good for the community, whether you don't use Oracle anything ever in your entire life. We're paying people to fully develop features, and I'll go through what those features are in my other presentation, upstream. Number two, we invest on the back end, support resources. Those two things are ways that actually show value to our customers. Okay, now on the back end, we also do a significant amount of testing. If you take a look at the average upstream developer, not Linus, not the creme de la creme, but the average person, they don't have a SAN at home. They don't have quad-core blades to test with, et cetera. Right? So that goes from upstream to Fedora. Most people in Fedora, once again, don't have major SANs or major data centers to do regression testing on. Okay? Then you go to Red Hat. Red Hat will certify the DL380s, NIC driver, or whatever to work with that piece of hardware. Okay? In Oracle, what we do is take that a step further, what's called a validated configuration, where we test the HBA adapter with the SAN, with a certain version of the database on a piece of hardware, with a certain version of our database and applications, validated configuration of the full entire suite, not just, hey, does this NIC work with RHEL 5, right? We take that kind of a step further. I'll go into that as we progress. So answer to some of the other questions, do we include codecs? No, it's a desktop offering. We don't look at the desktop. We don't have a client offering. It's completely server-focused, so we don't have to answer those questions because it's not the market that we're going into. Yeah, a lot of the questions you're probably thinking of, I'll be covering in my presentation after this little 5-minute spiel is done. So if you can hold questions for then, I would appreciate it. Cheers.
Okay, first we need you all to smile. Big cheesy grins, leers, that'll do fine. That's just for the record. Okay, Richard will be immensely flattered because Mandriva was derived from Red Hat originally, and they decided they could do some things better, and sometimes they have, but it's just the way with the world, not everything. When they picked up Red Hat, it was RPM-based, Yum was a dream in someone's eye, not reality. So they built a little system called URPM, which is sort of like apt-get, you know, it's a sort of meta-manager for RPMs that does all the dependencies and stuff like that. And the other thing, of course, the Mandriva developers are French. Now, I don't know if you've paid much attention to the French, but you have a look at their cars, and you open the glove box, there's a light to tell you that happened. You open the bonnet, there's a light to tell you that happened, and so on. They have different ways of doing things. I'm qualified to speak on this because I was actually born in Canada, but anyway. One of the things that Mandriva did was started life as Mandrake because it was a cute little name and they liked it. And they ran face first into intellectual property regs because the owner of the Mandrake the Magician trademark got very uppity and jumped up and down and threatened to throw lawyers and stuff, so they had to change the name. So they picked Mandriva because it was phonetically close-ish and they wouldn't have to change too much and it still sounded good. And if you have a look in the systems and stuff that are inside Mandriva, you'll find things called Drac XXX because it's derived from Mandrake. So there's a bit of history wired in there. As well as the URPMI package manager, which is very much like apt-get. They sort of borrowed from each other on the way along. You've got a derivative called UIPMQ, which is querying, and you can do fuzzy queries, so it'll find approximately, or you can do exact queries, and you can case-independent, blah, blah. They also did all of the Drac series of essentially management software, point and click to do the install packages and configure hardware and blah, blah. I could have point and click to configure my laptop for the network here, but I cheated and had a chat with Kim in Adelaide while he was over there and set up a little script. Anyway, my laptop runs Mandriva 2008. They started numbering by version 7, 8, 9 and so on. And then around 2006, they got sick of that and started numbering them for the years they were released. And they sort of aim for about two releases a year. So this year, there's a 2008.0. There'll probably be about a 2008.1 in June, July. Like Red Hat, they're reasonably conservative with kernel versions and things like that. Not quite as conservative. They will actually go up a point if there is a significant security defect or something like that that is more completely fixed by going up a version. But they've been into clustering and they've done some very large military clusters and things like that. So they're aware of the issues that are raised by simply updating an innocent little software package. And they're very careful about that. And the codecs brings up another interesting topic. They're very, very clean about their licensing. The free distribution is really GPL. They're very careful about that. But if you want codecs and such, which come with what might be corporately regarded as a dodgy license, there is this crew called the Penguin Liberation Front. Now, that's a pretty good title to start with, but they're completely independent of Mandriva, and they've started to work on other distributions. And they put together things like codecs and so on, which have licenses which are more or less plain to you and I, Joe Random Average, but present a risk for the lawyers in corporate land. And so you can go and get all of the MS codecs and stuff from PLF archives, which are worldwide, same as Mandriva's, and plug them into your machine that will go happily. While they are careful again about shipping GPL stuff only with their free distribution, they do include things like PDF decoders and that sort of thing, free ones. And they also have a separate RPM repository tree for commercial stuff, for want of a better term. Not quite codecs and stuff, but specific applications, things like Opera, that sort of thing. Now, language wars. Most of their little Drac XXX and so on things were developed in Perl. So almost de facto, I know a little bit about Perl because of having to deal with little issues like this in early versions. Another language they use a fair bit of was Python. And one they used one of, which quite impressed me, was Ruby. with regard to the style of the packages they include, they've gone for a sort of shinier set of packages than Red Hat originally envisioned. So you've got not so much the codecs, but Caffeine and all of the other little players and stuff that rely on those installed from the core, as long as they're free. So it is what you might call a shinier distribution. It's got more pretties and googles than Red Hat typically has out of the box. And it doesn't quite have the same level of stability as RHEL, but it's close, and it's much, much better than quite a few others. The only other distro I'm really sort of familiar with is Ubuntu, but that's okay because I've used and supported several Debian servers, and I'm quite happy with that as well. And also SUSE, and occasionally Slackware. They all have their little places. Mandriva, the company, is a single French company. They have worldwide involvement in all sorts of places like Brazil. They've done fairly well. So they're not going to disappear overnight, but they are a single corporation with all of the risks entailed therein. But again, I mentioned them getting involved in clustering. They've got some heavy involvement in science and military applications because of that, and some fairly interesting contacts. If you want to sit down to a network that's got 500 or 600 nodes on it that will cluster by default when you switch them on and go browse the web, you become a cluster node. They've done that sort of thing, and they're pretty reasonably practiced at it. PLF, again, have a sort of division. They've got packages which are basically free, but you could argue the point in the licenses, and they've got packages which the licenses are dodgy enough that a corporation really wouldn't touch them, but an individual might be happy. So you've got the choice. You can switch on the kind resources, and you can switch on the go for broke resources, or any combination of the above. So the combination of Mandriva and the hangers-on works out pretty well all up, because it gives you a broad range of choices. In terms of general stability, it is pretty good. UIPMI is very good at pulling out the dependencies, picking just the ones you want, not installing half the universe at the flick of a keyboard. And you can uninstall things quite neatly. UIPMU for uninstall will go and pull off a package and all of the dependencies. It doesn't quite have the same cleanliness as apt-get in terms of chasing up unused packages and stuff, but for straightforward commands it works very well. I'm unable to predict where they will go in terms of development, but they're French, so it's going to be pretty. And yes, they are RPM based. They do have Alien and a few other things in there, so you can install Debs and the like, but it's not a big focus for them. And as I said, their RPMs are very clean. Like, you can get a Red Hat RPM source and do a simple RPM rebuild command, and it will generally come up perfect and run fine. So there's Richard's flattery again. They've stuck close enough to the distro that the bits will still work. I think that's about it. Question time. Yes, I think that's right, and it's a sort of recent addition, on demand, as it were. But again, the distro that they advertise as being free to download really is open licenses.
Sure, but it's not the recommended one.
It depends who's doing the recommendation. If they're trying to sell you a distro with club membership and stuff, then they generally include the non-frees, but then again, you've got people in there to help untangle that. The club still exists, and by being a member of the club, you get more access to the non-free software, and you also get to ask questions in fora which are not completely public. So basically, you exchange a little bit of money for better penetration of the organisation, so your questions get heard and answered more readily and more often.
But the non-free software also just can enable the repositories, right?
Basically, yes. But if you're not a member of the club, then you don't get a real voice in the support of the non-free stuff, because it does cost Mandriva real money to do that, on top of the real money that they spend on everything else.
Originally, Mandriva used to withhold, when they had financial troubles, one of the things they decided to do to recover, to get some funds in, was to create a club and withhold the release of the distribution, so that if you're in the club, you've got early access to the distribution. And this is something that they've changed now, because it really doesn't work.
Some of the dealing with the Mandrake trademark caused them immense corporate hassles, and that was one of the things they tried. They tried many things, and that was one that did not work too well, so they trashed it. Any more questions?
So just going on with that, financially, they did have a few problems that I heard about a while ago.
Yep.
And you said they are going all right at the moment, are they?
I wouldn't call them stars, but they're coping fine. A bit more than getting by, but they're not in paradise.
Do they have any engineers and stuff that contribute code back to other projects?
Yes. Yes, have you ever played Frozen Bubble?
Yeah, no,
that was a hobby of one of the Mandriva developers. And there's a fair few like that, but that one stands out because you can get it on little, you know, Nintendos. Okay. I got off fairly lightly so far, I think. Over to Jonathan.
Thank you.
Oh no, I've dropped you on the floor.
I get dropped on the floor often.
No, I would have dropped out.
Thanks, Ian. So next, we have Martin Michelmeyer.
Who'll be speaking on.
Who's speaking about?
Whatever's on the chair.
I'm just giving a quick overview of Debian. So Debian is one of the largest and oldest community-based distributions. Some people call Debian, it's one of the slogans we sometimes use, is the universal operating system. And that's because Debian tries to do a lot of different stuff. So Debian is very large in terms of software packages, has about or over 10,000 source packages these days. So you can find almost everything in there. And Debian tries to do a number of things, like, for example, so we have specialized software packages. So there is an effort called Debian Med for the medical area. There is something called Debian Edo for education. So it's really, you can use Debian for quite a few things. And one something Debian is used very much for Debian-based distribution. So if people want to modify, customize their own distribution, then that's something which Debian is used very often for. So there are a couple of regions, for example, in Spain, they have their own Linux distribution that's based on Debian. In terms of the release cycle, or the way Debian is being developed, we have three different versions you can download. So there is the stable release, which is being made about every 18 months. Then we have what we call unstable, which is the development version. And then we have something in between. So we introduced that a couple of years ago. And that's something called testing. So packages are being put into unstable by developers. And then we have a number of different criteria. And if they are fulfilled, so if a package has been in unstable long enough, if there are no release critical bugs, then the package moves from unstable into testing. So testing is something which is being updated every day. You get pretty up-to-date software, and usually it's tested. It's probably doesn't break, at least not nearly as often as unstable. Even though unstable is pretty stable as well for a development tree. And so we are now doing security updates for testing as well, which means that people can use that. In terms of licenses, Debian has three different sections. So there is main, which is the largest one, and that only includes free software. So Debian has something called the Debian Free Software Guidelines, according to which we decide whether a license is free software. Then we have contrib and non-free. So non-free are obviously things that are not free software, according to our opinion. And contrib is something in between. So contrib are applications that are free software. However, they depend on software that is either non-free or that is not in Debian at all. I think the distro summit is very useful. What I hope is that different distros actually get together and talk to each other to see how they can work together. So I think something Debian is very well known for is that we work very well with upstream developers, so with the original developers of the software. We really are acting as a bridge between users on one hand and the developers of the software on the other hand. However, I don't think there is so much contact with other distributions, which I think is a shame because we're facing many of the issues we are facing are very similar. So there are some things where we do cooperate, and security updates is a very good example. I think that works very well, but I think there are many areas which we could cooperate more. And it's not just an issue Debian has, it's I think most distros don't actually talk to other to each other. So there are a couple of sort of issues that I wanted to raise that I think are going to be a deal for various distros. And that's something Debian has, I think in the past few years has gotten a pretty bad sort of people have a bad impression about Debian because they've done a couple of things which were quite drastic or extreme. And I'm not happy with all of them either, but I think that those are issues which do concern the whole community, and I think we need to discuss them. So one of them is firmware. So Debian has decided from so Linux, some kernel drivers, they need some binary blobs to operate. And so most distros simply include those binary blobs, and they just say it's data, and even if you don't have the source, even if you can't modify, well, we don't care. So Debian had loads of discussions about that and in the end decided to remove those binary blobs. I think that was a decision that was made too quickly because we really need to think more about that, but that's a decision we have made. But I think that's something we, as a community, we have to think about some more. And the other example, which I think people agree more that that's an issue, is stuff like documentation licenses. So Debian said that the GNU free documentation license is actually not free, is not free software because there are things like invariant sections, so you're not allowed to change some things. So some people say, well, and clearly that's against the idea of free software. I mean, if you can't change things, I mean, you know, that's against the idea. But then there are some people who say, well, but it's not software, it's documentation. And for documentation, maybe the same rules don't apply. And I think that's an interesting discussions we need to lead because it's not just documentation. There are things like images. For example, if something is GPL, you need the original source code. So what's the original source code of an image? For example, if you include a PNG that is generated by a script, would you have to include that script? I think there are a couple of issues. I mean, it's just not clear what freedom means when you apply it to other things than things that are strictly software, like documentation, images, all kind of multimedia things. So Debian has some opinions about that, but I think we really need to engage the whole community to discuss about those issues. Another issue I think is that the Creative Commons, which is basically being used for all kinds of multimedia and for documentation, is actually, people don't have a problem with some of the clauses like non-commercial use. Some of these CC licenses don't allow commercial use. And it seems that some people don't have a problem with that, even though it's clearly against the idea of free software. So I think we need more discussion about that. And interestingly enough, I think that philosophically, Debian is actually most closely aligned with Fedora. They really care about those issues as well, like codecs, Ogg Vorbis, patents, and stuff like that. Sorry?
Fonts.
Yeah, fonts is another issue. I mean, there are just so many new issues which we haven't thought about in the past. So I hope that the community can engage about that. Another issue are processes. So Debian has a bad reputation because to some degree we can't make decisions. Our release cycle was very bad in the past. It was always delayed, so we're improving those things. But and it was funny, when Gentoo was started a couple of years ago, people looked at Debian and then they looked at Gentoo and they said, oh, you know, Gentoo does everything right. And they basically laughed about Debian. And a couple of people in Debian said, well, just give them a couple of years and then see how things work. And if you look at Gentoo now, I mean, it's horrible, it's a disaster. And well, it's true.
We have
and and I think that's a big issue, because many projects start as a small project and then they grow, and suddenly you have completely different issues. And most projects don't really cope with that very well. So I think we need to look into processes, into how do you grow a project, how do you still maintain a healthy community, even if you, after a couple of years, you go from like one person to 1,000, because things have to change, and projects don't really know how to deal with that. A final issue are technical issues. It always amazes me how much duplication there is. Even though, I mean, people in distros, they re-implement things even though it wouldn't be necessary. So why is network configuration done differently in every distro, for example? I think that, again, is something where we should work together.
You didn't steal yours from Red Hat.
Sorry?
You didn't steal yours from Red Hat. That's what's different.
So are there any questions? Yeah, well, that has been another issue. I think we've been improving in that area, and that's partly because of the Debian women effort, which was quite strong a few years ago. People have realized that the atmosphere we used to have was really hostile, and I think people have realized that that's not the way to go. And nowadays, people are thinking more before posting. I think we're still not. I think we still need to be stronger and tell people who post flames that that's not the way to go. But I think we have definitely improved. Market share, well, that's very hard to say. Because, I mean, we're not selling Debian. And, I mean, there are some major vendors, like PHP, who are doing that. But we don't really know. I mean, we're definitely interested in working with large corporations. But I think that few of them are actually interested in working with Debian. I'm not sure exactly what to do about that. And the other issue we have, so there are so many Debian-based distributions. And again, they re-implement everything. And it's really important to get them together to see what kind of issues they face. But that has been very hard, because people do things in their own way.
I'm going to follow on the gentleman's question. You're wearing the t-shirt, so how's the relationship with HP going from them giving back to you, whether bug reports or fixes or whatever? From a community point of view, forget money, forget market share, just raw
right.
Contributions and assistance.
So actually, you do work for HP these days. So I just joined in December, but I'm not working on Debian as part of HP. So what I'm going to say now is my community perspective. But I think that HP is doing pretty well. So they have donated a lot of hardware. So most of our infrastructure is actually based on HP hardware. And they've also given some patches to us. So for example, Dan Fraser, I'm very happy about his involvement, because he's taking care of security updates for the kernel, which is a very thankless task. And in the past, we didn't handle that very well. But since he's doing that, and that to some degree overlaps with his work at HP, things have improved dramatically. So there is some. So HP offers Debian for telcos and provides support for a number of servers, and they give big changes which they're working on. So I think we're pretty happy about that. So at the Debian Mini conference yesterday, we had some discussions about that. about other companies. I mean, IBM, we know that IBM uses Debian internally quite a bit, but they haven't really supported Debian at all. So we don't have any, well, we have some hardware, like some PowerPC hardware, but that's all there is. We don't have any contributions in terms of manpower patches, and that's really what we are interested in most. And Sun has donated some hardware. I think they're interested in Debian because they are using Ubuntu, and so they're interested in making sure that Debian remains healthy. But again, we don't see very much involvement. There was someone recently who wanted to test, so from Sun, who wanted to test Debian on their hardware, and we gave them some pointers, but then nothing happened, so I don't know. So I think that's something we are looking, like we would be happy to work with large corporations, but most of them aren't interested.
Yeah. The freedom question, good to hear you discussing that. Say you have a NIC or some random little device, and it comes at the moment with a blob, and the people who produce the blob offer you the source code for the blob, but it's some odd dialect of 8051 assembler, or an odd 68,000 derivative or so on. So you've got the source code for the blob, but you don't have the tools to turn the source code into another blob. So how do you have a simple solution for solving that?
Well, I think at the moment, if there was source code and you would be able to modify it, that would be fine, even if you don't actually have the tools to use it. I mean, that's why I said that the decision about removing firmware was just premature, because even if we had the source code, we wouldn't actually do anything with it. It's just very, like, you know, that's our philosophy and that how it has to be, even though there is no pragmatic reason. And the other thing is, at the moment, if we would remove the firmware from an Ethernet driver, at the moment, the installer doesn't support loading non-free firmware. So that, again, something we're working on, but at the moment, it doesn't exist. Which I think is pretty bad.
And you would like it as a non-mandatory option, so that people can feed us a floppy in when they're booting and get the driver if they need to, but normally not.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, we intend to support something like that. But again, I think that's a pretty large issue. I mean, in an ideal world, we would have the source code, we would have tools, and people would actually fix bugs in firmware. I mean, there are bugs, and it would be great if we could fix them. But the reality at the moment is there aren't tools, there aren't source code. So in my opinion, it doesn't make sense to remove firmware or to require that at the moment. I mean, it was like Richard Stallman, when he started writing GNU, I mean, he used a proprietary Unix. He didn't just say, well, I'm gonna write it down on paper, because I'm not going to use a proprietary Unix. And I think that's the same with firmware. I think we should have the goal of having free firmware, but I think it's not the reality today. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then it's cheaper, even if it's just like 10 cents or something. Yeah, I think that is definitely going to get worse.
So I don't think it's bad that it's being addressed at this point, because otherwise it's just going to get hard, whether you go. So at the moment, if there are supported architectures that you can install without any binary faults whatsoever, there's a huge number of them. It's primarily laptops and some of the other stuff
All that means is a binary block that goes onto an EEPROM on the device, like when you install code and stuff.
Oh, I know.
Excellent. How is that different?
One trend I've noticed from an oil little manufacturers like TP-Link is that they have tended to build their hardware around devices that already have Linux drivers and everything else. So they don't have to have the hassle of maintaining their own driver set, because it's already done.
I guess the big modern change is where you have classes of devices like USB and stuff, where you have generic driver that work across a whole range of hardware.
And then you run into arguments about how should you manage a mobile phone when someone plugs it into the piece.
Yeah, any other questions? Otherwise.
Okay.
So now we'll throw it open. Who here uses a distro that has not been mentioned so far?
You do.
Okay, there are a bunch of you. What?
Sliz.
Yep.
We have a call for Cyclops at this point. Basically, we need a stable distribution which is supported, and Space was cheaper. We get it for the white Cyclops, cheaper than Red Hat. I think a lot of people are Cyclops, might prefer Red Hat.
Yep.
Developing it.
Okay. Is there anybody that would be willing to get up for a couple of minutes and say, this is my distro? It doesn't even have to be one you use, it's what you know about. You will? Okay, great. Come on down. We have a contestant.
Come on down.
I think you need to stay towards the back a little bit, or
yeah,
get
sure.
To the green.
Hey, everyone. I can possibly answer a few Gen 2 questions. Please don't throw anything.
Even coffee,
yeah. When I first started using Linux, there was a little thing called RPM hell. I don't know if anybody's ever come across that. Yeah, it drove a lot of people to Debian. Unfortunately, at the time when I tried Debian, it wouldn't work on my brand spanking new Ultra DMA 66 IDE controller. And not having enough experience, I just went searching elsewhere. So I did the whole Red Hat, I did the Mandrake at the time, I did SUSE, which did destroy one of my hard drives, but I kept on searching. In the end, the only way to deal with RPM hell was just to install everything, and I didn't really like that. And in 1998, I think, or 99, I came across this thing called Gentoo. And I read about it, and it struck me as interesting, because I was really keen to learn about Linux and open source software. And I installed it from source, and it did take a very long time. But the first time I installed it, it worked. And the next six times, it didn't. I had lots of problems. But the first time, it actually worked. And that was great. And so the great thing about Gentoo at the time was it just resolved dependencies. If I wanted to install an application, it would just pull everything else down that was required. And coming from the RPM hell side of it, it was like heaven, source heaven. So that's sort of where I came from. And I used Gentoo for a number of years.
Use the source, Luke.
Yeah, I used the source. I also have to say that nothing has ever given me as much joy using free software as Gentoo. I learned more using Gentoo in 3 months than I did in 3 years trying to use Red Hat, Mandrake, and those kind of RPMs, and so RPM-based distros. And so it really fed my appetite for open source software. So I really enjoyed it. A couple of years ago, I created my own variant of Gentoo called Corora. I don't know if anybody's heard of Corora. A couple of people have. Two, three, four, five. Cool, five people. You have now, yeah. At the time, Gentoo didn't have an installer. Everything was manual. And I had a lot of friends who I was talking to about this Linux thing. And they said, yeah, that sounds great. And so I said, hey, I'll come over and help you install Gentoo and teach you stuff. Unfortunately, it was a bit of a steep learning curve for them. And I ended up just maintaining all their systems and installing everything. And I remember teaching a few people who are excellent Linux guys now, but at the time it was very frustrating. So what I decided to do with the help of my friend Matt up there, who was one of the frustrating guys to teach at the time, I decided to write an installer. So I got together with Matt and we said, hey, what if we could actually create Gentoo, but we'll make our own binaries, we'll package it with an installer and then put it on a CD, and anybody who wants to try Gentoo, all they do is they put in this CD. They run like a Debian installer, it's ncurses based, and they install Gentoo, and it takes half an hour, and then they can start playing with the system to learn it. So that's what we did, and that was good fun, a lot of fun making that distribution. We also created the world's first XGL live CD, which was really cool fun. I was at work, I hope my employer doesn't see this, but no, I'm just kidding. I was at work and I didn't have much to do, and I thought, hey, I've heard about this XGL thing. I wonder if I can get it working on Gentoo. And I was like, yada, 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 yada. A couple of hours later, hey, I have this full fancy cube desktop thing. This is awesome. And then I thought, I haven't made a live CD. I wonder if I can make this into a live CD. So I started hacking. 2 weeks later, I had this live CD and I released it out. Actually, it wasn't the first. There was somebody who did beta. Some distribution in Spain had released it a day before. But we're sort of on the other side of the globe, so I sort of said, well, maybe, you know, time zone difference, we might have actually beaten them. But anyway, so that was good fun. We got a lot of press and all that sort of stuff. And then I got a couple of emails. At the time, we were including NVIDIA and ATI drivers on the CD.
Ooh.
Anyway, I got some emails from some kernel developers, some death threats from some kernel developers saying, you cannot do this, this is illegal, take them out right now or we'll do nasty things to your children. I don't have any children, so anyway, not that I know of. And so anyway, that I did from that point, so this is why I'm quite interested in this whole free software argument, because at the time it opened up a whole new world to me. I never thought about this sort of thing before. I just sort of did stuff and packaged it away. So I did about 6 months research and I asked everybody at the Canberra Linux user group on their perspective, and everybody I talked to said it was fine, didn't have a problem, until somebody saw who wrote the email and they said, ooh, that guy knows what he's talking about. Maybe you should take it more seriously. And so I actually decided to withdraw the binary drivers from Corora and release only the Intel and the Radeon open source driver in the latest version. And then since then, I pretty much stopped working on the project because CompUs is with everything now and live CDs, everybody can make a live CD these days. So yeah, but anyway, so that's sort of my history. These days I use Debian or Ubuntu just because it worked on my MacBook, which was amazing, suspend and resume, so. There you go. So if anybody's got any questions about free software, GPL, why Gentoo sucks so much, or anything else, I'm happy to try and answer some questions. Nobody cares. All right. Did I get frustrated? No, I loved watching the source code scroll by. Seriously, it's like a buzz. One of the great things that Gentoo, if you're not a Gentoo person, you don't realize, Gentoo has this thing called use flags, and you can set use flags for specific things you want built into your system. So if you don't want any GTK application, you don't want any LDAP support built into any of your resulting binary packages, you set a system flag minus LDAP, and then everything you build will never have anything to do with LDAP, unless it's a direct dependency, of course, otherwise it won't run. And so this enabled you to have, you can build it for an embedded system, totally customized. You could build it for, you know, big bloated whatever Ubuntu like kind of whatever you want to have. So it gave you this power and flexibility that no other distro and easily compared to something like Linux from scratch, right? So it's really fun. So no, I didn't really get bothered by that. Sure. Yeah, so if you upgrade, well, big example, actually for the flags, no. For the flags, it's really just passing to the configure script, so enable this, disable that. But you do run into issues like upgrading glibc or whatever, which, you know, if it's a major upgrade, you'll break all your binaries and things like that. But there are tools to fix that, and you obviously got to know a little bit about what to do. Yeah.
The question was, you said that it did teach you quite a lot. Mm. I mean, if you're just doing an e-merge of something that somebody else has put together, like the force thing or e-build or whatever the hell it is, how is that different to installing a binary?
Well, the Gentoo installation process is entirely command line based. So you have to manually fdisk partition your hard drive, manually create a file system on it, manually mount it, manually extract tarballs, manually mount proc and dev, bind dev, trut in, edit all the most of the configuration files. You'll need to edit manually by hand.
More is the installation process than just deciding that you want
package. Sure. The package is easy. I mean, I want GNOME, emerge GNOME. That's it, right. So when it breaks, that is when you then have to go, oh, why did that break? And then you start to figure out, oh, what's this thing called GTK? And, oh, why did GTK fail? And so then it starts to teach you how dependencies work. But more on the system side, when something goes wrong, I mean, manually creating your file system tab and setting options like no A time or whatever you might want to set, all of these things. So if any Linux computer breaks, I usually can fix it because of the background that I have in Gentoo, which is a really fun and valuable thing for me. Yeah.
You said you started this.
Corora.
Knowing what you know now, would you do it again?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the best fun.
Cool.
But the you were saying, you know, what's the purpose of it and why create another distro? Well, Corora was really designed for Gentoo people, or people who were interested in this Gentoo thing, didn't want to sit through the whole process. So it was really for a niche market. It wasn't trying to be an Ubuntu competitor or anything like that. And of course, there's only two of us. So.
What you have done seems like a recurring pattern these days. There are many distributions which are derivatives of existing distributions.
Yep.
And we're now facing the problem of merging change back and forth,
yep,
rebasing and contributing your change stuff.
Yep.
Do you have any solution to that?
Well, for me, it didn't really matter because the Gentoo people didn't want to know me. So. Well, I mean, that made it quite easy, too, for me. Oh, okay. Hey, I've done this thing. We don't really care. Oh, fair enough.
It usually so happens that there is, like, it looks like a fork to make it. So
yeah, sure. Well, a fork kind of, yeah, I see a fork slightly differently, that a fork is often where there's a dispute, but the resulting goals are still sort of similar. You know, you might have a fork of, let's say, Debian, where we believe in non-free software, we believe in codecs, we believe people should have access to binary blobs, they might call it Ubuntu, or something like this, right? So that's kind of how I see a fork. What I did was really just take Gentoo and give people an easy way to install Gentoo. I actually called it an install method for Gentoo. So.
You know, this kind of fork can be actually be very beneficial.
Sure.
If it doesn't result in forking everything else too.
Sure. You're right. People always say there are so many distributions. I have another website called makethemove.net, which I try to address open source software and promote open source software. And as you were saying before, one of the things is there are so many distributions, and shouldn't there just be one way, master, or whatever, right? But what you're saying is that if somebody stays in a distribution and they think X is a good way to do something, the people in that distribution might disagree. And then that benefit, or that potential benefit, is never realized. So what happens is people fork, people split, they do their own thing, and down the track, when they say, actually, that was a really cool thing, then it can be brought back in. So why make another distro? Well, because Mandrake didn't like the way that Red Hat did things, and they wanted to go a different path, and now everybody benefits.
No, so maybe not to make myself clear, I totally agree that it's good.
Sure.
Decided to stay close to their upstream and work with them. And this doesn't happen as much
yeah,
as it should,
yeah,
just because of not political, social issues.
Yeah.
Problems.
Yeah. I don't really have an answer for it. I think part of it is that the original distribution don't want to know. We don't agree with that. I mean, if somebody came to Debian and said, hey, we've got this awesome firmware installer, and then Debian says, well, we don't believe in firmware, so what can you do? I don't know how you sort of bridge that until both parties can see that it's a beneficial thing. I hope I answered somewhat your question in a roundabout way. Did you have one more?
I was just going to say on that, I don't think it's a terribly bad thing if all of these distributions are dealing with the upstream of the packages. So if somebody finds a fix for a package and they send it back upstream, then it bans out to everybody anyway. It doesn't necessarily have to go back up to the parent distribution necessarily.
Shuttleworth pointed out that it's not not happening as fast as it should. And so when it happens, then the packages go upstream. The other distributors have already implemented the same fix 10 times.
Yeah, sure.
Although there is a lot of